You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good afternoon, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ. Bill, I have to assume that is not really your backdrop. It's too beautiful. This has to be one of those Zoom tricks, right?
This is not a Zoom. I'm actually on a beach. I don't always get to have leisure time, and I'm not even sure this counts as leisure time because I'm with the family, but I am on a nice beach.
It looks amazing. I hope that slightly off camera is a margarita or something.
Well, you know that's not how I roll, Matt, but
No, I was talking about me, Bill. Look, when I drink these coffee, you never know what's in the coffee cup. You can't just assume it's coffee. Let's see. So this is the second time I've seen you in 2 days. We did a DM Zoom yesterday with Joe Trippi, which I think went great. And I'm out tomorrow on assignment. So this is it. No, for fans, this is we're going to have to bring the heat right now, Bill. This is all they get.
A lot has transpired, I feel, since you and I talked less than 24 hours ago with Mr. Trippi. And we should give him an extra plug. He's starting a new podcast, That Trippi Show, which is excellent.
Yes, please subscribe to that, rate and review it. It's a good show, and Joe is a great guy.
Absolutely.
And we had a solid conversation. You can find it. It's not up on my audio podcast yet, but if you want to listen to me and Bill and the gang talk to Joe Trippi, it's on my YouTube page right now. So search for that.
So just today, Herman Cain passed away from COVID-19.
Yeah, it's sad.
And Congressman Louis Gohmert contracted it or was found positive and proceeded to tell his staff in person of the news, and then insist, even though he rarely wears a mask, blame the times he did wear a mask for getting it.
I thought that took extra moxie to blame not only our masks pointless, according to Louis Gohmert, but they actually possibly gave him coronavirus. And took a lot of
it did.
Chutzpah, I believe it's called.
It is. That is the proper phrase. But you know, in some sense, I mean, like it would be chutzpah if he knew better. And the fact that, and I don't make light of Herman Cain's passing. Yeah. I don't think we know he got it at the Tulsa rally, but he was at the Tulsa rally.
Well, it seems likely because several people apparently got it at the Tulsa rally. And then I'm talking about Trump. There were Trump staffers who got it, I think, in Tulsa and weren't even allowed to go do the advance work at the facility. So it just, the timing seems.
But why should I even assume this is the only thing Herman Cain did that could have exposed him to coronavirus? But I think the larger point seems to be, as much as we are frustrated by Donald Trump pushing out a lot of misinformation or bad information about coronavirus, both he and a lot of other Republican political officials and conservative activists, you know, they believe it. I mean, it's not like they're telling a lie and then they're behind our back being very careful. They seem to truly believe they should not wear masks. They should be in crowded settings.
Some of them. I know. I can't name names. I know some of prominent conservatives who are bashing masks, who are personally taking all sorts of precautions. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Herman Cain was willing to die for this. I mean, in a sense, you could say that. I mean, he did something that was kind of dangerous. And I think, the other day, Patrick Ruffini, the Republican, operative strategist, said that if Major League Baseball were to get canceled again, that would be more devastating for Trump than like anything else, because it would just show something that we thought was opening and then it gets pulled back. Mm-hmm. And that would show how bad COVID actually is for people who still don't admit to that or believe it. Well, here's a guy who was pretty well known and very, I mean, just sort of say like very likable. I just put up a video of an interview I did with Herman Cain in 2011. I don't know if you remember this, Bill. I have the video because Herman Cain turned it into an ad where he was talking about him and his brother growing up in segregated Atlanta, Georgia, and they snuck a drink at the White Water Fountain. And the what Herman discovered is that they were astonished that the water tastes the same. Now, some people could look at that and say that Herman Cain was saying, what's the harm in drinking out of a different water fountain that tastes the same? But I think what he was saying is, why are we going through, why are we separating from each other? Why are we doing all of this? You know, it's pointless. Whatever the case may be, Herman Cain, as far as I could tell, was a super nice, friendly guy. And he is now dead because of coronavirus. And so, like, if you're a conservative out there and you're thinking, well, this is no big deal, well, we now have a pretty good piece of evidence that it really is, that it, that it's a life or death issue.
Do you think this will shock the sensibilities of the skeptical conservatives? Is it going to cause anyone to reorientate their thinking on coronavirus?
I think it will. I don't think anyone's going to cop to that. I doubt if you're going to have people go on Fox News and say that. But I think, I mean, I have to tell you, like I said, I know people who are public figures who are sort of bashing the idea of wearing masks, but they're very careful. I think I told you the Lewis, my Lewis family reunion, the Lewis family would have voted. I mean, if we did a, you know, Trump would have won 100% of the vote at my family reunion last year. They unanimously voted not to have a reunion this year. So they're already behaving personally much more cautiously. And I even think that rally in Tulsa, which was sparsely attended, part of it simply is that a lot of his voters, a lot of his supporters, I think, made the wise choice not to go into a super dangerous situation. So I don't know that anyone's going to say this. I doubt if anyone will. But this is another data point. If you're paying attention and you're a conservative, oh, by the way, you know, a prominent Republican who ran for president in 2012 just died of COVID. I mean, it's hard to ignore that.
And also today, Trump raised the possibility or posed the question on Twitter.
Just asking questions.
Should we delay the election against all legal provisions because mail balloting is sketchy? And I was struck by the number of Republican officials that came straight away and said, we're not moving the election. We can't move the election. What does that tell you about Trump's standing in the party? It's a ludicrous statement, but a lot of the times Republicans rally around as ludicrous statements. Why are they not rallying around this one?
Well, look, I think a couple things. One, I was probably less impressed by them than you were. Rubio, I saw, maybe I didn't see all of them. Rubio was pretty full-throated denunciation of what Trump did. Kevin Cramer from North Dakota played it off like it was a joke. Like, right. He's just trolling you. Well, that's BS. It might have been Tillis. Somebody I saw kept saying the election's not moving.
Right.
But he wouldn't say it shouldn't move and Trump shouldn't be saying this because it's irresponsible. He would just say, like, the fact it's not moving. Well, guess what? That's a fact. It's not moving. Mm-hmm. But how about a little more? How about I wasn't quite as surprised or pleased with Republicans. I will say, I think just in general, we've seen a lot of distancing. I think Republicans see the writing on the wall. So we see people like Ted Cruz, all of a sudden, Ben Sasse, all of a sudden worried about the debt and the deficit and the spending. And clearly they're, you know, hedging, you know.
Well, I think is that distancing from Trump, or is that I need to get on some intellectually coherent ground before I try to block Democrats from spending when Biden gets in office?
Well, I think it's an acceptance that Trump is going to lose, which Trump would take as a threat or an offense. But it's an acceptance that Trump is going to lose, and it's trying to position themselves. I think they want to position themselves to be able to say, I stood up when Trump was spending. Mm-hmm. I didn't wait till after Trump was gone. I caught him out at the time. Ben Sasse did that on his election day after he knew he was going to win re-election in Nebraska.
We won the primary.
Yeah. So like a couple, you know, within basically once the die was cast that he had won the primary, which I think is the election, by the way.
In Nebraska, anyway, sure.
Once the die was cast, he ran an ad criticizing Trump. So he can say, Ben Sasse can honestly say, he was the only Republican to run a primary ad criticizing Trump. Now, it's complete bullshit, but he can say that. And now Ted Cruz, and they can all say, Josh Hawley, they can all say, like, we stood up when Trump was president. We criticized our own team for spending. And they'll be able to say that. Now, it deserves a ton of asterisks, you know, but they'll be able to say it. So that's – now, the other thing I've noticed is Eric Erickson – who started off being a vehement Trump opponent, later endorsed him, now seems to be off the bandwagon. I can't tell.
Honestly, I cannot. I don't like track his writings, you know, on a regular basis. He pops up in my Twitter feed sometimes, and I literally like never. Like, how many times this guy flipped back and forth, and how much energy do I want to spend trying to figure it out?
Yeah.
which is almost none.
And then Rich Lowry of National Review, who started off, remember National Review put out that piece against Trump.
Mm-hmm. The whole magazine. Then, the whole magazine was against Trump.
The whole magazine, but Rich Lowry runs National Review.
Right, right.
He was against Trump. Then he wrote a book in praise of nationalism and essentially started trying to buddy up to Trump without going full Trump. Now he is criticizing Trump. I mean, I think rightly over Trump's moral equivalence between Putin's Russia and America. So even before today's news, now what happened today that would cause Trump to send that tweet? Well, we found out that the second quarter of this year was like the worst economic quarter in recorded history. So I don't think it's a coincidence that tweet. I think that Trump, I'm not so, you know, look, we need to be vigilant to preserve liberal democracy. And I think Donald Trump clearly has posed a threat to that and to our norms and to our institutions. And if you were going down the how to be a dictator or how democracies die checkbook, postponing elections is on that play, like the playbook. Right.
Right.
I mean, that's one of your moves is postponing an election. Having said that. Because of we're blessed to live in a great country still, despite our problems, that has these guardrails, and because it's very clear that Trump is losing, I see this more as an act of desperation and almost a tacit admission that he knows he's going down the drain.
And if that is the case, you would presumably see, you know, Trump's fundraising begin to struggle. You know, he banked a lot of money in the first half of the year, but he might have a hard time keeping it going. Will Republicans be able to regroup enough to say, we got to draw a line at the Senate? You know, we got to start having the message that, hey, whatever happens to the presidential, you want a Republican Senate to be a check on Biden here. Please give money to the, you know, RSCC and give money to our vulnerable swing state senators, et cetera, et cetera. Or is there too much of a every person for him or herself going on that level of coordination can't happen?
I can't speak to that, Bill. I can tell you that I was embroiled in it. I don't want to say heated because – I wrote a piece at the Daily Beast where I made the argument, and I started this off. Since I made this argument, David French has echoed it, Ramesh Panuro has echoed it, but I was the first. The pioneers take the arrows sometimes. So I made the argument that because Trump's loss is essentially a fait accompli, barring some miraculous comeback, which you never know. But because it seems that Trump is destined to lose, and because Democrats already control the House, that if you are a conservative, now look, if you're a liberal progressive Democrat, this doesn't apply to you. But if you're actually a conservative who cares about abortion or whatever, taxes, fracking, all the things, gun rights, whatever your thing is, it might be good to keep one check on Biden, and not just on Biden, but on the left. I mean, Biden has you know, been pretty good at doing that himself, but I don't know how long he can pull it off. And so I went on the Bulwark podcast with Charlie Sykes, who disagrees with me, and I would commend this to you if you haven't heard it yet. It was a very good, I think, very smart debate and discussion. I think if you listen to it, you'll get a sense for the pros and cons. So I took that position, Bill, that I think it would be, if you're a conservative, you should be rooting for these very flawed Republican senators to at least hold onto a tight majority of one branch, to have one check and balance on this incoming administration. But I don't think it's going to happen. I mean, I think Republicans are going down big time. I think they're going to lose the Senate and the presidency. And that's not, I think you know, Bill, that is not a bold thing to say at this point. That's probably conventional wisdom.
I mean, I think it's becoming conventional wisdom that Democrats will take the Senate, but I think the range of it is still a little up in the air. I don't know how many people are really think it's going to be a clean sweep. You know, I mean, Democrats are now down 3 in the Senate. I don't know how many people are saying they're going to get to plus 5, which is theoretically possible at this point, but I don't know how people are really going that far out to predict it, because you still got a number of close races in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, if you want to be a check, if you want Biden to have a check, I understand your argument. Better to have a Republican Senate than a Democratic Senate that will ensure a check. I think that is just a tautological truth. But there's a difference in being a productive check that prevents Biden from going off the left-wing rails, and being an obstructionist check that just ties his hands all together from doing anything.
Yeah.
And I do think there is, I mean, I think if McConnell's the majority leader, you have a high likelihood of just straight up gridlock.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. I mean, it would be naive to say you're wrong. I mean, modern history suggests that this is the move. However, just to play devil's advocate here a little bit, a couple things. One, we haven't had a one-term president since George H.W. Bush, right? So it's been a minute. It's been, I'm not good at math, Bill. It's been decades. What America's faced in recent years, really since 2000, is two political parties that seemed evenly matched and thought they were one election away from being able to impose their agenda. And so that created a circumstance that disincentivized any form of compromise. There was no clear daddy party or majority party. What's the term? There's actually moon party. Is it the sun party and the moon party? Or I've heard it put different ways, but there is no clear dominant party. And so there's been this struggle, and that has disincentivized cooperation. Mitch McConnell, if Donald Trump goes down in a landslide and Trumpism is discredited, and Mitch McConnell, who is a pretty pragmatic, you know, he's a very shrewd, tough operator, but I don't think he's an ideologue at all.
He's a partisan.
Let me frame this as a question, Bill. Is there a chance that the scenario shifts whereby it is Mitch McConnell, who's going to be God knows how old the guy's going to be by, you know, or even is, he will have just won re-election. Trump will have just been defeated bigly, according to my. Is there a scenario where McConnell's incentives change?
McConnell's, no. I mean, all evidence is that he is a partisan from start to finish, doesn't want to get crosswise with his base unless, like, there are certain things. Like he
didn't used to be that way. He was kind of a civil rights pioneer.
You're talking way
a long
back.
Time ago. But he was also, I mean, Bill, I'm old enough to remember when McConnell was viewed as a rhino squish.
Oh, sure, but that's not today's McConnell. McConnell is enough of a partisan pragmatist to know I'm not going to allow my base to go to me into a shutdown because that's bad for my party. So I will stand up to them on that score. But there's not a lot of evidence that he's willing to work with a Democratic president to advance a Democratic idea with the intent of standing off the rough edges and making it a little bit, pull it more to the center. That's not the guy McConnell has been. Whereas if you had the true blue wave, that you gain 7-8 Democratic seats, you're at 54-55. You're winning in Iowa, Kansas, Montana, maybe Georgia, maybe Texas, maybe North Carolina. I don't think McConnell changes, but you have the possibility that Biden can work with, you know, 5 to 10 different Republican senators, depending on the issue, and get the 60. Because in that scenario, you will have a push from the left, and the partisan wing of the Democratic Party to say, "Screw these guys."
Junk
the filibuster, ram through the partisan agenda. Don't give these guys a second to tie your hands. And you're seeing Biden weigh that. Just to take him at face value, he's saying, I don't think we have to do that, but the Republicans are going to be really difficult. We're going to have to consider it. My guess is this is negotiating tactic on Biden's part. Doesn't really want to do that. He's been an institutionalist his entire life, believes very strongly in bipartisanship as far as keeping the country unified and keeping policies sustainable. I think he'd much rather use the leftist stance as a bargaining tool to reform the filibuster in some way, but not outright reject it and get that cooperation from 5 to 10 Republicans. So I still think that serves as a check. It allows for Biden's agenda to be contained and be more literally centrist. And that might be more conducive than trying to feed the notion of more, you know, rank partisanship.
I feel like if you're a conservative, so there's Comity, and then there is
capitulation.
What's that?
Capitulation.
Well, yeah, okay, and I feel like if your goal is peace, then go along with it, but. I think there is going to be pressure from the left, particularly if they have all three. If you're a progressive activist and you want to do something radical, and the Democrats now have the presidency and the Senate and the House, and you don't get it done, that's tough, right? Biden has done a good job of standing up to them, but he has currently an incentive to do it. The incentive is that he's running for election and against Trump. Can he be that strong for 4 years? Biden flip-flopped on, for political reasons, on abortion. I mean, he used to be pro-life, then he became pro-life, but vehemently opposed to federal funding of abortion because he said, should my tax dollars go to pay for something that I'm opposed to? And he flip-flopped on that under duress, and now support, you know, and now opposed the Hyde Amendment, supports taxpayer funding or federal funding of abortion. What's to say he won't change on a lot of other stuff too that are frankly less fundamental issues. And, you know, the other thing, too, is a president delegates. They appoint judges. They appoint people. They hire bureaucrats. The things that they actually are in charge of are a small percent of the things that happen in an administration. And then I think there's probably going to be pressure if Republicans do stymie their agenda to get rid of the filibuster. Chris Coons, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, Bill, was somebody who was really against getting vehemently opposed to getting rid of the legislative filibuster. And I think he's basically said, like, oh, well, we need to look into it or, you know, something.
Well, yeah, I mean, Coons and Manchin, people who were very explicitly against getting rid of the filibuster, have recalibrated their language to a degree that, in a way, that cracks the door open. I personally think that is more negotiating tactic. I think these are guys who are institutionalists. And Manchin in particular, someone who comes from a state where being bipartisan is pretty necessary to survive. And if there is a big blue wave, you're going to elect a lot more moderate Democrats from red to purple states who are probably not going to be dying for their very first act to strip the one element of the Senate that is intended to engender bipartisanship. So it would take a lot, I think, to break them on that. You know, to your point, you know, Biden's a politician. Biden has moved on various issues over his career. He is, I think, interested in maintaining party unity as much as possible. But at the same time has a strong interest in bipartisanship and institutionalism. So these things are at some tension. You mentioned the Hyde Amendment, which is a perfectly fine example to cite. There's also the Medicare for All example, where Biden has been very resolute against a lot of pressure to budge on that. I mean, here he even has a Bernie Biden unity task force that tries to slip in just the phrase Medicare for All as a rhetorical nod, and then it goes to the full platform committee, and that gets scotched. Biden does a endorsement interview with A.D. Barkin, who's a diehard Medicare for All supporter, has ALS, and asks Biden point blank, or says to Biden point blank, I'm a Medicare for All supporter, and Biden says very bluntly, I'm not. So there are some things Biden doesn't budge on and some things Biden does. So
or hasn't.
So the game is on to try to move him, you know, once he is president. And I just think if you are a institutionalist Republican or a Republican that doesn't want to see just outright gridlock and the further degradation of the democracy, you want to give Biden something. So he doesn't become enticed to junk the filibuster altogether.
Well, you know, I don't want to relitigate the entire debate I have with Charlie. People should go listen to it at the Bulwark. But, you know, fundamentally, I think it comes down to, you know, well, there's a lot of interesting sort of angles to this. But one argument is that it would be better for the Republican Party to burn it all down and start over, which strikes me as not a terribly Burkean conservative concept in general, but that's what they want to do, and that's their theory.
That was my argument in 2016. I had a piece about that in the New Republic.
Republicans should do that.
Yes, that at the verge of Trump being nominated, that the standard Republicans should just say, look, this party is tainted for good. And let's just leave it and start something fresh, because being inside of this tent is not a good tent. And of course, no one listened to me and they won the presidential election. But perhaps that will get revisited if Trump loses and Trump doesn't relinquish control of the party.
And my book, Too Dumb to Fail, was arguing that the Republican Party was in incredibly bad, shameful condition, and that we had to take immediate action to reform the party and salvage it. So that's my instinct, and to reform the movement and salvage it and fix it. So that's my instinct to do. And I mean, the other context of this debate that I had, Bill, is, you know, the Lincoln, if an individual says, like, I can't vote for Lindsey Graham, okay, mm-hmm. I totally get it, okay? Mm-hmm. But the context was, like, the Lincoln Project, who's taken in tens of millions of dollars, or, you know, they're making ads telling, they're ostensibly a conservative group who wants to restore conservatism, and they're telling people to vote against all these Republicans running for Senate. And I just wrestled with that. Is that prudent? Is that the right thing to do? And ultimately, I came down that it's actually not. That if you assume, if you assume that Trump is going to lose, and I think that's the assumption, I would like to have a check and balance. And just because Cory Gardner or Ben Sasse or Susan Collins are spineless politicians doesn't make them Trumpians. And I think if you they're not going to win any profiles in courage, but if you change the incentives, if you change the environment, if you change the head of their party, I think that they can still be part of a functioning democracy, and actually, instead of working against me, they can start working for me, keeping other guys in check.
Well, it depends on the person. I mean, I actually, if I'm a Lincoln Project person, I wouldn't go after Lindsey Graham. I mean, as you know, devoid of intellectual consistency as he has been, and you might say it's, you know, perhaps he deserves punishment for being so bluntly against Trump in 2016 and then becoming such a sycophant, you know, mere days after.
Annoying.
What's that?
Yeah. It's very annoying.
Yeah, it's annoying. It's annoying. Yeah. And I'm not saying he is honorable in doing so, but just from a strictly utilitarian perspective, the history of Graham is someone who likes being in the room, likes to make the deal.
The room not, where it happened.
Not easy to bring along. You know, he was slippery for Obama, but, and I've pressed this in the show before, I think his interest in a climate bill was real. I think he stuck his neck out pretty far. Enough for me to say, you didn't have to do that. You didn't have to go to a South Carolina town hall and say you're for cap and trade. That's not a necessary thing for you to do to keep your seat. You must mean it. And as awful as he's been to the person he thinks is the most wonderful guy in the world, Joe Biden, he could suck it up and be a sycophant of Joe Biden all over again if it meant that he get to be in the room and shape a deal. So he would have value in a Biden administration in a way that perhaps Steve Daines or Joni Ernst would, or John Cornyn would not.
I also think there's a danger with what the Lincoln Project wants to do with this, like, inverse, I forget what it's called, but basically the easiest Republicans to beat are people like Cory Gardner and Susan Collins, right?
Right.
But you're not going to take down Josh Hawley. You're not going to take down Tom Cotton. Ted Cruz is even up for re-election this year. And you're probably not going to take him down anyway. So you end up with a Republican Party that's worse, smaller, but worse. And, like, if your goal is to rebuild the Republican Party, is subtraction, is getting rid of the best, you know, granted, it's a low bar here. When I say the best, I'll use air quotes. Mm-hmm. But is taking out the most sort of moderate and sane Republicans the first step of fixing the party of Reagan and Lincoln?
If you went on the list, I mean, let's assume that there was a clean sweep and all these guys lost. I think you're correct that what remains of the party will be as it gets more and more purified.
Yes,
you have fewer and fewer targets for opportunity for bipartisan cooperation. But you would have, you'd have a couple of octogenarian senators, I believe Grassley and Shelby, who Biden, I'm sure, knows and have worked with him before, who probably won't run again. So perhaps he can make some personal appeals there. You would still have Murkowski, who has gone rogue before and won as a write-in after losing the Republican primary. So she has a bond with her state that can withstand some idiosyncrasies. You would potentially still have Lindsey Graham. you have someone like Ben Sasse, who is a little squirrely and hasn't really done something bold and really crossed party lines before, but perhaps...
Oh, he's bold now, Bill. He's very bold.
Well, he might be less bold in a Biden administration, but perhaps worth talking to.
I give him a special hard time because he was someone that I had high hopes for, but my hopes are always dashed. Look at Marco Rubio.
Well, all these people are reliable. It's not like I'm going to say take it to the bank. These people are going to work with Biden. I'm just saying these people. If I was counseling Biden, I'd say give these guys a call. I
mean, yeah.
Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania, bluer and bluer state, did break ranks on gun control before. I would call him up. Richard Burr, North Carolina, that state might turn blue again. He broke ranks on Don't Ask, Don't Tell under Obama, was seen as a fairly bipartisan guy during the Mueller investigation, working with Mark Warner. He is a guy that I would pick up the phone and call. Rob Portman was not an anti-free trade populist. So he's an old Bush guy, might be a guy you could talk to. I mean, all low probability people, you know, but if you're Biden and you're like, I really want to avoid having to get rid of the filibuster, I really want to show I can make this work, those are the people I'd make the personal appeal to. Can you work with me at least on this one thing or that one thing so we can show the country's going to function again? You don't want this to be a Trump-led party. You don't want to go back to Trumpism. You got to make this work if you don't want that to happen and make your party sane again.
Bill, I've gained like 7 to 10 pounds. I can't see this, thankfully. 7 to 10 pounds since this whole shutdown happened. Have you had this problem?
Well, I think I front loaded my weight gain before the shutdown, so I'm still plateauing.
You were very smart to do that. I unwisely waited. Now it's bikini season, and you're at the beach.
You're landlocked.
I'm going to go to the pool later.
Before I don't want to wrap things up just yet.
I'm
enjoying talking to you about politics more than my weight. But
the fans demand a certain amount of this chatter.
You're welcome to do before and after DMZ photos from 10 years ago when we started. VP.
I feel like we're holding our own. We may look better today than we did 10 years ago. Now, if we can do that another 10 years, I will be very impressed with us.
We should talk VP because we are possibly 1 week away. Biden has said by the end of the first week of August, which would be August 8th, Biden has slipped past deadlines before, so I don't think that's a hard and fast expectation. He could easily go past it for another week or even though it's a week and a half, he won't actually want to go into the convention. But we've gone through this period in the past 2 weeks where we've had a Demings boomlet, we had a Duckworth boomlet, we had a Bass boomlet, we're now in a Rice boomlet. And maybe we're having a Harris boomlet right now as there was a story in Politico that Chris Dodd didn't care for Harris's answer about the busing attack in the first debate, and that sparked a notion of Harris is just too ambitious. Biden doesn't want to be looking over his shoulder. It's someone that is not putting his interests first. And now you're getting why is it all of a sudden to be an ambitious woman to be bad? Why is it bad to want to be president if you're getting named to be vice president? Since when is that considered a negative?
Not. I mean, if you're at this point at this level of politics, you're pretty ambitious. I mean, and ambition can work for you. Reagan made James Baker, Reagan picks his adversary who called his plan voodoo economics, mm-hmm. that's George Bush, and then takes Bush's campaign manager, James Baker, and makes him his chief of staff, thereby setting up a scenario where the only way Baker can win is if Reagan wins. So,
right.
Ambition can work for you. These are ambitious people. I don't think it's a deal breaker. And by the way, Chris Dodd, as you know, Bill, has an interesting track record with the whole Me Too thing.
Yes. As I recall. Well, so I mean, that's being that card's being played against him to say, hey, don't let this guy derail
yeah,
you know, an ambitious woman. But, you know, Chris Dodd should know better because he shivved Hillary in 2007. I mean, that was probably the pivot point in the 2008 primary was Hillary Clinton getting knocked around for not having a clear position on immigrant driver's licenses. And Dobb was the one that plunged the knife into her. And Joe Biden was not so pleasant towards Barack Obama, said flat out he's not ready. In a Newsweek interview, and then he's asked about that in a debate, and he says, "I stand by the statement." And Obama, of course, looks past that and makes him VP. So,
and let's not forget, Bill, when I was up for this job, you wanted Kirsten Soltis Anderson. The email that you sent to Bob Wright about me, we've been able to work past. We do counseling.
Have you been able to produce that email? I see no evidence of this email.
We do counseling to get past it. And look, this has flourished for a decade. So these, you can get past these. I do want to say this, Bill. You mentioned Politico. They had a thing where they announced that Joe Biden picked Kamala Harris. And there is a conspiracy theory, which I'm part of, advancing right now. Because this is very fishy, Bill. Now, look. Media outlets will pre-write things, you know, like obituaries. You know, there's an obituary already written for pick an old person who hasn't died yet, right? Mm-hmm. And it could accidentally get published. But here's the thing. What you would never do is include a quote, a real quote. You would just put in like X's or like quote in capital letters, like put quote here, something like that. There is a quote from Joe Biden in this, and I'm telling, there's something fishy about this that leads me to believe that they may have gotten a heads up that Kamala is the one.
What you would really never do is pick your VP a week plus in advance, write out a press release with a quote, feed it to a news organization, and say, "Hey, you just sit on that for a week. You just sit on that because I'm going to make everybody sweat for a while." But trust me, that's the decision.
I know you're a homer here. I know you're part of the Politico magazine family, and I don't want to put you on a spot. Let me just say it. This is Matt Lewis saying it. Because I pre-write stuff too. I mean, you got to. If it's a debate night, you might have one column where Biden wins the debate and one column where Trump wins the debate. And then you fill in the quotes. What you don't do is make up quotes, because that could accidentally slip through and be published. You would just put in like insert, you know, I can't believe that an outlet would do that. That's what makes me suspicious of this.
If I was writing placeholder text, I would not use a quote in my placeholder text. But someone casually doing that is still far more plausible to me than Biden giving them the quote days in advance.
Okay, if Kamala Harris is picked, will that make you revisit this,
I've been saying Kamala's the front runner from the get go.
Okay, so that won't matter. That won't persuade.
I mean, my personal rankings from March, which was not meant to be predictive, just my personal rankings, which were published in Politico, had Kamala number one. I then had a tweet, I think it was April, where I said Kamala is the Joe Biden of the of Veep stakes, not worthy of your hot take, but probably going to get it. But I did say probably. I wasn't making a flat prediction, but I do think she's very likely. Yeah. I mean, what I can't know it comes out in the vet, and I can't know if it's just a personal. But I just can't get over it. You know, if that's the case, that's the case. I think it's silly if you can't get over it for all the reasons previously stated.
Yeah.
But
I pitched a real hot take today that no one bid on, for obvious reasons. It was Biden should scrap the whole thing if he wants never Trump votes. The list needs to be Amy Klobuchar, John Kasich, and others.
Well, you want to whiten it up.
Nobody bit on that pitch, Bill. But why can't we have nice things? Why can't that be in the mix?
Well, why is Klobuchar and Kasich so nice?
I think if you want to win, look, if you're Joe Biden and your goal is to win never Trumpers, they should be on the list at least.
Every polling piece of polling data we have is that he is already winning never Trumpers. He doesn't need to bend over backwards to entice them to win. He has
already been taken advantage of, and I'm not even voting for him.
The challenge for Biden is to maintain the big tent that he currently has. And I think the expectations are higher within the Democratic base that he picks a person of color and most likely a black woman than there is on the never Trumper side of the fence that he picks a anti-abortion Republican as his vice president.
Amy Klobuchar, I stand by this bill. Amy Klobuchar, I think, was the best pick. Now, what happened, you know, the police abuse, the murder, all that stuff, the protests, that did her in. I mean, that did in Amy Klobuchar, especially since it happened in Minnesota. But I still think she was your best pick if your goal is, like, do no harm, let's win Pennsylvania, let's win Michigan, let's win – anyway, whatever. Joe Biden's probably going to run away with it. Let me ask you this. Do you think someone like John Kasich – and I'll just use him as a placeholder for, like, generic moderate Republican – will end up in the cabinet of Joe Biden?
I think Biden will have at least one Republican cabinet member. I don't know if it's going to be John Kasich. I mean, they wouldn't put Kasich near anything like HHS, where he would have some influence over abortion policy. Or he wouldn't be Department of Labor, would have influence over labor policy. So I'm not quite sure where you would put him. But I wouldn't totally discounted. He will have Republicans. I mean, Obama had Republicans in his cabinet.
I think everyone has had, every recent president at least has had
at least one.
One other than Trump, right?
That's right.
But Trump
right.
did talk to Tulsi Gabbard. There was
there's some Manchin talk and Heitkamp talk.
Right. And yeah, Heitkamp could have taken it instead of losing. I forget how that played out at the time. I once upon a time, I knew the intricacies of that story.
How seriously do you take the Susan Rice boom?
I take it seriously. I think it would be a mistake, but I take it seriously.
Is it a mistake because of Benghazi?
Partly. I just think there's too much baggage. It's a pick that harkens back to the past, a past that Biden's already got enough baggage and credibility and baggage, the good and the bad. So I think it would be a mistake. And then also, she's involved in, like, you know, the unmasking of Flynn, right? And
that's not a real thing.
Do you want to give – there's going to be this Durham report that Barr puts out. I don't know what's in it. I don't know what may come out. At the very least, it gives them an issue.
Well,
it gives them something.
Well, I agree that there are enough Susan Rice conspiracies out there that it will become a distraction to have to put those fires out, even if they're not of
any merit.
I don't
think Biden needs that.
I agree with that. In fact, when I made my rankings, that's what I said about Rice. I had her on the list, but low down for that reason.
Condi, I think, is a different story. Let's put her on the list.
Well, I don't think that's going to happen either. I'm a little sympathetic to the notion of, you know, pick Rice and tell these guys to shut the hell up, which is sort of, I think, part of the Rice boom, is that don't let these conspiracy theories dictate how you behave. Now, there is a foreign policy exploration of Rice by Michael Hirsch that brought up those types of things. But brought up another point, which I thought was, I think, particularly relevant, is that, you know, she has a reputation for being a very tough bureaucratic infighter.
I think she's mean. I used to sit at the, I used to spend countless hours at the MSNBC green room when Obama was running for president, and she would be in there. I'd be in there for hours with her sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm not exaggerating.
Mm-hmm. And you like her?
No. When I never spoke to her, she wouldn't give you the time of day. And she wasn't like the, you know, national security advisor at this point.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Well, she was cold as ice.
Which, I mean, there's value to that. Like, I don't think she should be disrespected that she is, you know, tough, all business, gets her way behind the scenes. Like, these are attributes. I don't know if they're vice presidential attributes. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, if you want a Dick Cheney vice presidency, maybe. But
I like that. That's your next pitch, Bill. Although it's not a perfect analogy. It falls apart because she's a lot younger, but there's something there.
But I think this is a person who will be looked at as, is this person presidential material? And that goes beyond just the nominal experience. She has the foreign policy experience to be commander-in-chief.
Yeah.
Does she have the light touch
that you need to be politically... She's never been elected
to anything, right? Exactly. She hasn't had to deal with those types of scenarios. And there's the one where, well, she only had to campaign on Zoom, so who cares? Like, that's... This is because you're not shaking hands. Like, that's not the end-all, be-all of electoral politics. We dismiss these smile more critiques of female politicians, but men have to smile too. You still have
talk
to be
less, smile more.
I mean, Trump may be an obnoxious exception to the rule, but generally speaking, it's a good rule that people like you. And Kamala, quite frankly, is a very ebullient politician. I think she is tough. And she smiles. She has gone through the process of having to learn how to make personal connections on the campaign trail, and whatever weaknesses she has in that score, I don't think that's one of them. And if you're going to say, well, she wasn't perfect because of this or that, you know, Karen Bass and Tammy Duckworth and Demings and Rice haven't had to do nearly as much of it as Harris has. So you're not getting a great apples-to-apples comparison of their skills on that score. And so you may find out too late in the game these other folks aren't as good at it as Harris is, even if you think Harris is not super-duper at it.
I think we should do every DMZ show from the beach. Do you think Blogging Heads, the suit to Blogging Heads, seeing how good this went today and how good you look, maybe could find some place in the budget to send one of us to the beach to do these?
They are welcome to include that in our very luxurious pay packages.
Yeah. Well, you know, we're up for a contract renegotiation soon, where I'm going to have my agents talk to them. I'm going to get Matt and Keith on the phone and see what we can do.
Where's the picturesque spot in West Virginia that we should do this at?
Dude, West Virginia, where isn't the picturesque spot? This is almost heaven. John Denver, baby. Blue Ridge Mountains, Shenandoah River.
Are you river rats now? Do you go swim in the river?
I'm not a big fan of that, but we have been to Great Kakapin, the state park, where the kids have gotten in. That's a lake. But there's a lot of rafting here, and so I'm really close to pulling the trigger on a kayak, Bill. I'm going to become that guy.
See,
so
I would be that guy if I wasn't afraid of capsizing my family.
Well, you know, they do make these life vests, which we'll wear. So we'll see how it goes. It's developing.
I feel bad because we live near a river. I live very close to I live near the Connecticut River, pretty major river. And there's lots of boating that people do on it. And I'm just like, I'll never live with myself if I kill my family on the river. So I've generally stayed away.
Well, now that you put it that way. another excellent episode of the DMZ, Bill. Let's see. Let me just plug once again our Joe Trippi conversation.
Yep.
So if you want to be – so let me think of – we've had Ross Douthat, Ramesh Panuru. Were you on with Ramesh or was that just me?
I was not on with Ramesh.
Okay. Let me strike that. We've had Ross Douthat, David Frum. I've had Mike Murphy. I don't know if you were on.
I was not on with that one.
Although I think your fans, your patrons were invited.
Yes. Same with Ramesh.
Did I say Steve Kornacki?
Not yet.
We had Steve Kornacki and we had Joe Trippi. That's pretty good. And so if you want to be a part of these calls, these chats where you can talk to cool people like Joe Trippi, Steve Kornacki, and David Frum, you can give us money at patreon.com, Matt Lewis or Bill Scher. And we will not be doing our normal Friday happy hour this week, sadly, but we'll hopefully be back with that next week. And if you want to see, as of now, the Joe Trippi thing is on my YouTube. If you just Google me and Joe Trippi. And what was the title of that one, Bill? Something to do with
That Trippi Show.
No, that's his podcast. Oh. Our podcast with Trippy was called like Chaos. Okay, and
Chaos,
Community.
Chaos versus Community.
But you should subscribe to Trippy's podcast, That Trippy Show, which I think is about hallucinogenics. I'm not sure. They may touch on politics as well. also, there's a new Animal Farm update.
Animal Crossing.
Animal Cross. I keep getting that wrong. My son's going to kill me.
My children are fighting over it right now.
So that's a good reason for us to end this show, Bill. Always a pleasure. Have fun. What a great vacation, man, where we can get to do the DMZ.
Absolutely. Until next week.
All right. See you guys.
Bye.
See you, buddy.
All right. Take care.